describe your approach. Like, okay, you're starting a company from scratch. I would say, like, it's just a question of priorities. And I would say this person's priorities is building an awesome team. They're recruiting like high level people and then like really setting a cultural foundation around that. So that's like the non poking fun way of looking at it is like, that's their priority.
So
what's your priority when you like start an endeavor? Did you see this email I sent you? So I forwarded you an investor update I got. Did you see that email I sent?
No, from who?
Well, I can't say, but because I was sort of like, you know, this person's smart. They've sold a company before.
Which address did you send it to?
I don't know. Maybe you're like hustle one. I don't know. But just see if you see an email from me. Anyways, I'll just explain to you. You don't even need to read the email. Basically, this is like, I was like, this is so different than anything I would do. And I was like, if this person wasn't already successful, like they built a cool company before this. They are a smart person. I've met them before, but they, you know, their company updates or their investor updates are highly like, aspirational. Like, so they haven't launched yet. The team is like, it's like, oh, the team is growing. We have like, I don't know how many people they have, like 30, 40 people now. We did our, you know, a second offsite because remote work, you know, is hard to build our bonds. And on our offsite, we played these games and we did this mission statement thing. And here's our values. And then like on top of the values, we're thinking about like how to build a culture that's really, you know, transparent and collaborative. And like, they, again, haven't launched yet. No revenue, no nothing. But like
professional photographer.
But yeah, have a professional photographer. The update is like super robust. And like, again, on one hand, I'm like, when I read this, I'm just like, oh no, like this is like, it's like watching a car drive off a cliff. It's like, this is like all the parts of a startup, except for the important parts. And like, I know they must be doing the important, they must be building the product too. It's not like they're not, but like, I would never prioritize these things in my own companies. I know you're the same way where we're both a little bit like, you know, brash and like, you know, you're like, no, the office doesn't have cups. Like we use these,
use
like
your hands.
You know, yeah. Like, can you put your hand like this?
Yeah, like, what do you think hands are for, dog?
Yeah. Like they don't call me Sam Hosewater Parr for nothing. Like grab the hose and suck some down. Like if you need some, I'll bring it to your desk. So you don't even have to waste time.
He's convenient.
The hose is 18 foot. I sprung for the big one. It's like, and so I know you're like me, where like we do this like very bootleg company building. And like, you know, oh, like we look up and it's like, oh shit, we have 18 dudes. Okay. Diversity. Yeah. Okay. Like we're, you know, we're going to change that. Or it's like the company culture is like, oh yeah. Come to my house tonight. I'm going to cook for you guys. I don't know what, like, so can you guys just stop at Safeway and just buy like a bunch of chips? Like everybody here likes chips, right? It's like, yeah. All right. Everybody likes chips. Everybody go buy your favorite bag of chips. That's what we're doing tonight. Like, you know, it's like these kind of company building at the minimum, and it's like the as you go style. And then I see this and I'm like, either there's just like many play styles, that's how you can win in different ways, or they're way wrong or I'm way wrong. I don't know. What do you think about this sort of thing?
I think that for a very particular type of person, I wouldn't be concerned about this type of email. I think that you should most likely assume you are not that person. not even like you, but like anyone, right. they should default to, they are not this person. Like if you are, some like big swinging dick, well, some big deal.
Here's the analogy. It's like Steve Jobs didn't like, you know, he was like a perfectionist. He would like build it and then release the perfect product. He wasn't trying to iterate. He didn't ask consumers for feedback, you know, like early and often. He was a product visionary genius. Okay. But like, to assume that you're Steve Jobs-ish,
yeah,
that assume that you're that is like dangerous. It's a dangerous path to go down.
I think this is a horrible idea. You and I have a friend that started a company, and when they were only two people, him and the business partner, they hired a CEO coach so they could help with culture building. That's another sign. But yeah, I think, and they would go to like retreats, like for like,
right,
this type of stuff. So no, I think that this is not a good sign. It's not very good at all.
All right. A quick message from our sponsor, which is, of course, HubSpot. Now, look, growing a business is tough, and it's tough because a lot of times you have to duct tape a ton of software together to make it work. I've been there, and it's a pain in the butt. You have this thing connecting to that thing, and the two things that are being connected, one of them breaks, or the thing connecting them doesn't work, and it's a mess. You have all these moving parts, and it's just a pain in the butt because you don't know where the single source of truth is. And that's where HubSpot's customer platform comes into play. Finally, you've got this single source of truth where everything is organized and tracked in one place. For example, if you have customers emailing you, they've got really easy ways to see who on your team is replying to which customer, what they're saying, and things like that. And you can track it all in one place. They also have a lot of AI supported stuff, which means that you can automatically know which type of messaging you need to send to that type of customer. And yes, it sounds natural, like a real person. I actually use it. I use it with my company, Hampton, and it works wonderfully. And when leads come in, you know which channel they came through, you know who's going to follow up with them, and it's all seamless and easy. So if you're interested, it's simple. Go to HubSpot.com and check it out and see how you can use it to grow your business.
Have you, describe your approach. Like, okay, you're starting a company from scratch. I would say like, it's just a question of priorities. And I would say this person's priorities is building an awesome team. They're recruiting like high level people. And then like really setting a cultural foundation around that. So that's like the non poking fun way of looking at it is like, that's their priority.
So
what's your priority when you like start an endeavor?
I'm doing that now. So like, I'm going to start getting into it and we can talk about it, but I'm going to start getting into something and I'm thinking like, all right, is this something that I want to build to sell or is this something that I want to run forever? Because that actually kind of matters on how you set up your entity. Okay. So I think about like, what do I want personally? What type of life do I want? And how long do I want to operate this for? So that's
what would you do differently? Let's say own forever or build to sell. What's the core difference?
Well, if you want to pay yourself from the business as you go, an LLC makes sense. If you want to sell the company and you're willing to not pay yourself a little bit, or you only want to pay yourself as a W-2, then you want to be a C-Corp. And if you want to, I guess you could be an S-Corp, but if you want to sell your company in 5+ years and take advantage of QSBS, which is $10 million of $3 million of tax savings, then you for sure want to be a C-Corp because you can't get that on the other two. So I would think about like that, like what type of structure do I want this to be? Of course, I have a history of getting hits. So like, if you don't have a history of like making money, then like, I wouldn't even worry about this shit. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like I've proven to myself that like, if I say I'm going to do something, I follow through, you know, right. You don't want to be the nerd that just buys business cards before you even have anything done.
Great point. Okay. So that's like literally a company structure. But, and by the way, I think I told you this, one of the kind of like lawyer people that's like kind of advising us, they gave us a pretty great structure that gives us best of both. They were like, just have a C corp that owns the business assets and that's what will be eligible for QSBS down the road, but then the C corp will pay your LLCs your LLCs for each you know the co-founders like as a management thing, and so you're gonna get personally paid out through your LLC. But you still retain the long-term benefits of raising money or selling a C corp.
Yeah. Is the stock owned by the C corp?
So the company, well, C corp is the one issuing the stock. It has the stock. That's the stock that we want to.
So if you do a stock purchase
and we can either, and then the LLC doesn't need to own that stock. It's
then that's great.
Like a management company.
That's like savvy shit that I would have to like look into and make sure I'm doing it right. Because there's a clock. You need to own it for 5 years. Additionally, what you could do is you can issue shares to family members in different trusts. So many, many people could take advantage of the QSBS and other long-term capital gains, things like that. So I think a little bit about that stuff. And I think like what right now I'm every business that I'm thinking of, I'm think about how many employees do I need to run this and what type of employee am I going to have to hire? Because when you go big with some ideas, you're going to have to hire these like smart ass ex-Harvard, ex-Facebook type of folks. You don't have to, but you know, like that type of thing. Or is this like, no, I could actually hire this like $60,000 a year person, but where are they going to be coming from? And do I actually want or not want to work with that type of person?
Right.
So I think about who am I going to have to employ and what the business model is going to be. And so how stressful will that be? Advertising was really stressful because we had to go out and you're in it now. You got to hunt every single month And that could be a bit stressful. And so now I'm looking at what it's a little bit more recurring, which is less stressful. So I'm thinking a lot about business model. I'm thinking about what type of lifestyle I want. And I'm thinking about who I'd have to hire.
And you're thinking about these things, but that's not your priority list, right? So like, I mean, like in terms of action, right? So that's thinking and planning. Cool. That'll take you a couple days to be kind of noodling on that stuff. In terms of how do you like,
that's actually the hardest action. That's actually the hardest part is figuring out, because that's what Ben said. That's what
figuring out what you want.
But in terms of the action, I narrow it down to what's the one thing that can make this fail or work. And so let's just say that I'm creating, HubSpot. Let's say I'm HubSpot a few years ago, I'm creating HubSpot. So there's like a few items that need to work. Or at least I would think they need to work in order to make happen. So like, can I recruit engineers is probably one. Do people want this? And are my engineers even capable enough to create this? And so if I'm HubSpot, I'd be like, well, Salesforce exists. So I actually think that people can build this. Like it's, I'm able to build this product. And number two, I know a bunch of engineers and I'm pretty good at sales. I think I can recruit engineers. So then it's like, well, but do people want this? So that's like it's like, oh, okay, boom, that's it. That's the thing where it's like, I have to figure that out before I move on to the next steps. And so I go out and try to solve that. For a company like HubSpot, I would actually just do tons of phone calls and I would make a judgment call based on that. For this right. like little small copywriting things, the trycopythat.com, that just thing that yeah, I just, no, with that, I just put a pre-sale on there and I got $5,000 of pre-sales. And with Trends, we have $50,000 of pre-sales. So depending on how easy the transaction is, if it's $1,000 or less in transactional value, I can probably create a landing page and pre-sell it. We pre-sold this $1,000 thing for Trends and we were going to charge 10 grand for it when it came out. We pre-sold, I think we got $100,000. So we got $1,000 from 100 different people to launch it. And so if it's under $1,000, my first step is selling it and giving me myself 1 month to pull it off.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. To me, I simplify it like, how do I make sure, like, how do I figure out, do people want it? Step one, do people want this? And that's either pre-selling, talking to people, just kind of my own gut. Do people want this? Second thing is, where will I get customers? Okay, I think I could probably get the first 10 customers from here, first 100 customers from there. But like, on an ongoing basis, do I have like a repeatable way to get customers? And if I know the answer to those two questions, then I just go and I don't do other things besides those two things. I build the thing that they want and I give it to them and see if they actually love it or if they just kind of like it. And then I see if the way to get customers actually works. And once I do those two things, I don't really want to do anything else besides those two things for like a long period of time. And like all the other stuff, raising money, company culture, hiring, you know, corporate structure, naming, branding, packaging, design, all comes after.
Yeah. And you have to, my opinion is not only do you have to not, you have to like say, I'm not going to worry about that at this point, but you also have to say, I'm actively actually going to avoid it. So it's like, yeah. I'm going to like actively right. not care about it. You know what I mean? Like you have to totally. Like, and you kind of have to like take that stance. And I think there's actually some products where the question is not, do people want this? So like there's some stuff that I'll create that I'm like, well, I already know people want this. Like I know they're going to buy it. The question is like, can I even get customers to this repeatedly? Right. And that's actually,
can I tell you a couple tactics that helped me with this?
Yeah.
I wonder if you did something like this. So I have learned that it's actually best to be a little bit what I'll call brutal about this. Okay. So what do I mean by brutal about this? It is very easy. Like when somebody hears that, oh yeah, you first figure out, do people want this? And you try to like, you know, pre-sell it or offer it to them and see if they sign up for the wait list or they pre-buy or whatever. And then you figure out, where am I going to get customers repeatedly? And like you test that marketing channel and like those are the only two things you do. You say no to everything else. That sounds so simple. And then you like tell someone, go try to build a startup and they'll do everything else besides those two things.
That's because that's like the embarrassing hard stuff.
Yeah, because it's the hard stuff. And if it doesn't work, the car doesn't move anywhere. Whereas you could do a whole bunch of other stuff and it feels like you're moving. But the reality is you're not moving forward, you're moving sideways. And so, but at least moving feels like you're moving. And so people will gravitate towards those things. So let me give you some examples. Yesterday there was a tweet about Furkan, who's my old co-founder of my last startup. And Furkan is like, you know, a man of action, you know, a few words, a lot of action. And, you know, like if you ever ask him, like, when do you think you could do this? It is rare for him to not be like, I should be able to ship it tonight. Now, he only hits the tonight thing, like I would say 30% of the time, like 30% of the time, nothing happens. 70% of the time he gets like a crappy version that's like not ready. But like he'll at 2 a.m. there will be a message from him. Be like, here's where I left it. And, you know, like 10 or 20% of the time he actually finishes the thing. But he almost never says anything besides like, yeah, we should be able to do that tonight. And so I learned that from him, and every engineer we hired learned that from him. We're like, you can't give him a timeline. That's not tonight. If you say something besides tonight, he's just gonna be like, what the fuck are you talking about? So he now has this new like incubator thing, called F.Inc. It's dude, awesome.
What was that picture of that?
Dude, it looks sexy as hell, right? Like he bought this 10,000 square foot, or at least this 10,000 square foot space in Fort Mason. It was beautiful when everybody was leaving San Francisco and then remote work shut down all the offices and schools and in-person events. He was like the only buyer. He was like, yeah, I want a big space. I'm in the middle of San Francisco, in the best part of San Francisco. So he's like, you can see the water, the bridge. He got 10,000 square feet. He's like, oh, I'm going to put a robotics lab, a hardware lab, desks. I'm just going to have a bunch of engineers come make stuff here. You don't have to pay me rent. Like, just come build
stuff. And it's like beautiful. Like, it looks
and now
it
he,
looks
and he's like been renovating it. So it's like, it started with an empty blank shell. And now it's like, looks awesome. So
does he make a story. Does he make money from that? Or is he just spending money hoping that one of the companies takes off?
No, he's just spending money. He's like, he's made a bunch of money, and he's also just like, he invests in the incubator company and the companies that are there. Right. He invested a bunch of them, and like those are already doing well. So somebody tweeted out, somebody who's working out of there, they go, one thing that Furkan does around the office is if a developer spends like more than a day, I think it's like if you spend more than a day on localhost, which is basically just means like you're building your website project, but you didn't ship it to the world. Like nobody else besides your laptop can access the site. If you spend more than a day, he'll just start calling you localhost until you ship it. He'll stop using your name and he'll just call you localhost because you're just localhost now, right? Like you don't want people to use your product. So you just, all right, localhost, you want to get lunch? And like, I wanted to tweet this out. I knew people would take it the wrong way, but like that is a style we kind of incubated at our last startup. It's sort of like bully management. And it's not that you're bullying people. It's that you're bullying your values. It's like, how do I like live my values instead of just say we care about, you know, like building things fast? It's like, no, if you don't build things and get it to customers, you will get ridiculed here because that is not cool in our books. You want cool, you want respect, then you got to do the thing we respect. And like, if you don't, we're going to tease you until you do it.
I was giving a guy a hard time in the trends group because he posted, hey, so I've got 6 podcast episodes already recorded. Can someone give me an answer on which hosting platform is better? And I reply to go, well, that's not really the important question. The important question is, why did you record 6 with like just release one and
right.
and just post it? And someone was like, well,
by the way, so when I started this podcast, what did I do? I messaged you on Facebook. I go, hey, I'm starting a podcast that I think, you know, is going to be awesome. You know, here's the concept. At that, I was literally making it up as I was. I made up the name, made up the concept right there on the spot. I knew I wanted to do a podcast generally. And I go, you know, you have this awesome audience, but no audio content. I'll make great audio content if you'll put it in front of your audience. And then I was like, I'll send you the first episode later today. There was no first episode. I then go book a studio, record the episode and sent it to you within 24 hours in order for you to like see that I'm like being legit about it.
And it was
you
know, live like 2 weeks later, right?
Yeah, I was like, okay, this is ready to go. Like, here, it's nobody's listening to it, but it's in the store. You can go listen to the podcast if you want to.
The guy was like, we got 6 done. And I'm like, but that's not the question that you do. Like, the question is, why do you have 6 done and none live? Like, that's just crazy.
Right.
Because people default to, it's embarrassing and it's to post that shit.
So let me give you some other examples of this, of being brutal about it. At Monkey Inferno, when we were working there, we would sometimes let like kind of interesting engineering guys like just hang out in our office and we'd just be like, just work from here. No, you don't need to pay us. It's not a WeWork. It's like it's a sick office. We got extra space. Just come here and work. Just bring some good energy. And so these guys came and they were working there. They had this idea that was really cool. And then they were like, they would always ask us questions that were like this investor is interested. Well, you know, we're thinking about raising money. You know, how should we think about this? Can you look at our debt? Can you do this and that? I'm like, and it's like, hey, is your guy's product? Do you have your product built? Like, do you have users? It's like, it's just like, those are more important than this fundraising stuff. But like, I get it. It's flattering when an investor wants to give you money, but like, now that investor just took over your day, like now your day is all about that instead of like the main thing, right? Like, hey guys,
and whatever happened to
the main thing. So then they get into Y Combinator. They're like, oh, we got into Y Combinator. And we're like, awesome. Those guys will keep you on track. And then over the next 6 weeks, it was like, yo, you're NYC. Like, what's going on? What's it like to be in NYC? I've never done it. Like, heard it's awesome. And they're like, oh yeah, the office hours are great. They're bringing up this and that. And we're like, hey, so how many users you guys got? And they'd be like, and they would like, they didn't know the number.
Oh my God.
And me and Furkan just looked at each other. We're like, all right, new rule. If we ask you how many users you have, how many daily active users you have, and you don't know the number, like 10 pushups. And they're like, haha. We're like, no, we're serious about that. And then they still didn't know for 2 more days, and they had to look up the dashboard. And we're like, all right, 10 pushups not working. So we took a marker and we started writing a giant zero on the like the wall behind them. And we were like, this is the number of users you have according to us, because you don't know. So we're just going to keep putting zero here. And like, it's your job to like change this to be like the number of users you have. Every day when you come to the office, you're going to see this giant zero above your head until you change that. And like, again, this worked. And like, all of a sudden they started thinking about how many users they had. They didn't want that giant zero hanging over their head. And I've just seen many versions of this. I've heard a story about Peter Thiel doing this too. Peter Thiel's values were all about like focus. And so his thing was, everybody at PayPal, when he was the CEO of PayPal, would have one thing that they were responsible for. And the list could only be one. They had one big thing to care about. And if you tried to talk to Peter, like, hey, Peter, you know, yeah, the market, you know, the marketing stuff's going well, but I had this idea around this feature. He would literally just leave the room. If you ever tried to speak to him about the non one thing you were assigned, he would just ignore you. He's like, oh, that's not, remember, we decided what's important. So by definition, this is not important. So by definition, I'm just not going to talk to you about non-important things. So I'm going to leave, right? Like, I don't know how hard, I don't know how real that anecdote is because I wasn't there, but like, let's just say like directionally, it's true. I think that that is like a really important way to like operate a young company.
What happened to the guys from your office?
They ended up getting into YC. They ended up getting better. They kind of grew, but then they lost like once the growth wasn't like instant, here's my read of it. They pivoted. They pivoted and disbanded. They're all doing different things now. One guy's like, you know, working on a different company. Another guy's working on a different company. And the third guy I've never heard. I don't know where he went. And
probably found some cocaine somewhere.
And he had told me something once, which was just like, he was like, you know, he had told me something once. He was like they were building a marketplace of supply and demand. And like the reason we were all excited about them was because they got this huge amount of supply really quickly. They had just posted on Reddit and like people really wanted the thing. And so they started posting, but the demand side was slow. And he's like, with the supply side, it felt like I stepped on a landmine. I just like I took one step and it just blew up. He goes, I want the demand to feel like that too.
Dude, so...
On one hand, I respected that. On the other hand, I was like, dude, sometimes you got to like figure out how to get that to work.
I don't respect that. And the reason why is, you know, we're taught like, you know, people could change, we can evolve. And I think last year I made the decision. I'm actually going to assume people don't change. The way you are is the way you are and you're never changing. And that way of thinking...
How hopeful of you.
It's actually been... amazing, because like I'll meet someone and I'm just like, oh, you are a loser and you're always going to be a loser. You say you're going to do something, you don't do it. You don't have big dreams. You don't work hard.
It's like innocent until proven guilty. Through.
Yeah.
Yours is guilty until proven innocent.
100%. And then I meet someone who's just like a baller, like Steph Smith. And I'm like, oh, well, you're just a winner. So just like maybe sometimes you're going to swing and miss, but you're always going to swing. Therefore, I'm on board forever with anything you do, because I know exactly how you are and people never change and you're just a winner. You win consistently. Whereas there's a bunch of other people. There's this great article. It's called Losers Exist, Avoid Them. And it's the founder of Bleacher Report, Brian Goldberg. And he writes a blog post about how he interviews people. And he's like, yeah, see, I just think that losers do exist. And like, not everyone's a winner. And I'm just going to try really hard to avoid those types of people. And his way of doing it is he would say, I ask you about the bottom fourth of your resume. So where you went to school. So if I'm interviewing a candidate and she can't tell me like passionately about something that she studied for 4 years, it's like, oh, you're just a loser. Like you're not, you don't care about philosophy, even though you studied that for 4 years, you're uninteresting and thus are a loser. But you interview this other woman and she could like passionately tell you a story about something. And it's like, well, I don't even care about philosophy, but because you entertained me, like you clearly you are curious, you're a winner. So anyway, my way of thinking as of late is just people never change.
My sister has a great phrase on this. She goes, people will say that people don't change. They change for the worse. So her default is even worse. Yeah. Like, yeah, this person will change over time. They're going to get worse. They're going to decay basically and like harden in these like bad patterns until proven otherwise. I think that's actually a pretty good way of thinking about things. Dude, can I tell you about this last thing, like this experiment I'm doing that I think relates to this, which is like losers exist, how to avoid them. So here's my opposite.
That's a good line, right?
It's brilliant. Here's my inversion of that. Winners exist. Here's how to attract them. And so I put out this thing the other day. I tweeted out this. I was like, hey.
The $50,000 thing?
Yeah. I was like, yo, we just made 25 grand. Like a wire just came in for Milk Road for 25 grand.
I did not think that was going to work.
I want to give it all. I want to give it away. And I said that, you know, crypto is full of speculators. There's too many speculators, not enough builders. So if you want to build something, here's the deal. I will give away one ETH, which is like $3,000. I was like, I'll give you $3,000, no strings attached, no equity to build whatever you want. Like you scratch your itch. And I just want to give it to builders. Here's a link to apply. Go. And two kind of amazing things happened of how like winners exist. Here's how to attract them. First, a bunch of people who are winners were like, hey, great idea. I'll put in money too. And it was just an excuse to touch base on like a bunch of these winners. So the prize pool is more than doubled already. And like now we're giving away more money to more people because people are like, oh, this is cool. I want to.
It was like the Calm guy. It was Furcon.
Yeah, the founder of Calm. Furcon was like, we'll match it. And then like there was more people, but we were like, hey, let's just give away this first batch. And then like, if this is cool, we're going to like, we'll do more. We can just grow this into a self-sustaining like builder grant. It's philanthropy, but like, I don't, instead of charity, I'd rather give to like people building shit. And like, I'm sorry to, you know, people who are like, no, there's people suffering out there. I'm like, yes, but also like, this is where I want to give money to is something like this. And by the way, the whole, like a wire came in today. That was all bullshit. Like that was just like for the story. Like I was just like, I want to give away this. I'm willing to give away this much money. And the
people need to realize that lying for the sake of a story is actually okay. Have you remember the book that we read about storytelling?
Yes. Which one? Storyworthy?
Storyworthy. And he was like, he's like, just lie. Like, for example, if you're talking about like, yeah, so I was in the car with my teacher and she started flirting with me. Like, and he was like, well, there's actually like three people in the back seat. But like, I couldn't say that because it ruined the story. I
think his thing was like, don't lie to add, lie to omit details.
Yeah, meaning omit like, details.
Just omit details that don't add to the point of the story. And so, yeah, but mine was like, you know, I kind of just framed it as like, oh, a wire just came in. And
because a
like,
wire could have came in.
A wire could have came in and it did come in pieces. Like the money did come to me somehow.
You,
right? Like,
you received like, a wire that day.
And so like, but basically I told, like this came on a whim. So I told you we hired that new guy, Safwan. And I was like, Safwan, Safwan's 22, I think. And he's awesome. And I just like having winners around me, like young, awesome, energetic people who want to like make shit happen. And I was like, yo, I want more people like you around. I'm not going to hire all of them, but like, how do I just get more like, you know, when there was Peter Thiel did that thing where he like took like young people's blood and like put it in his body. I want to do
allegedly.
That. I want to put, yeah, I want young blood in my body. How am I going to do that? So I was like, all right, let me just put out a grant for builders. This will attract people who A, can build things. B, like know what one ETH is and like want one ether, like, and that $3,000 like means something to them that this could like unlock like a month worth of like, it's like an excuse to go build that thing. Right. So what happened? Almost 1,000 applications came in a week.
And how long is an application?
It was like a form that was like, you know, what's your story? I was just like kind of open-ended and it was like, what do you want to build? Give me the tweet pitch of it. Why do you want to build it? You know, what's your handle? What's your address? What's your email? What blah, blah, blah. And so people wrote in and I'll share the Airtable with you. It's kind of amazing. All right. So there's like a bunch of junk. We shortlisted like about 150 people out of the like close to 1,000 as like strong. Like this person's kind of like either their story or their idea is strong. And then we like kind of got to the finalists, which are like these 35 people that are like, okay, these 35 people, they all seem like kind of worthy of getting this. And we're ultimately going to pick like, I don't know, 15 or something for this batch of grants. And I think doing this, like this whole thing is going to take me, I think maybe 3 days total to like of attention to pull off. But what it's going to create is like just a bunch of young, awesome energy, young being just like not your literal age, but like more like people who like
psychographic people,
somebody who yeah, it's like somebody who has an idea, has energy, has optimism, and like doesn't think of all the reasons they shouldn't do it. Instead, they like, yeah, fuck yeah, apply. I'm going to do this. And so they're going to be around me. And I think this is going to be so ROI positive in the long run that it's like insane.
Dude, I've done these things before. And I think you did it before when you gave a business to someone, right?
Yeah.
And I've never had it work out. Like, it just kind of like went on the back shelf and they just kind of forgot about it.
Yeah, it could be. And like, you know, that's why the main filter is like, are you going to actually do anything? Or are you just talking about it? Or like, is your day job or your, you know, your student status or whatever going to just trump this and you never get around to like actually making shit happen? That's the number one criteria here. But dude, the stories are like amazing of like who writes in. It's like, it just reminds you of like, oh, wow, the world is way bigger than the like the amount of people that I interact with on a day-to-day basis.
Are you giving the money all to one person?
No. There's going to be like 15 people who get the grant.
And it's like a few grand each?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm eager to see what's going to happen. When are you going to decide?
We'll decide like in the next 5 days who gets it. And then we're just like setting up. Like we're just going to run the whole thing, you know, just like a Telegram group or something like that. And yeah, we'll see what happens. But I guess my point is, do things that create that like attract winners to you, which is the opposite lesson of like losers exist and how to avoid them. That's great advice. I think actually slightly less great advice is winners also exist. Here's how to get near them, get around them, get them around you, and like figure out different ways to like get them around you. This is one that like, you know, not everybody can afford to like do a grant program or whatever, but like,
yeah, but
if I had no money, I could have hustled and created this grant program instantaneously. I could have emailed, you know, 50 people and been like, hey, will you put up $1,000 for this? Here's all the benefits you're going to get. And, you know, which is how, by the way, I hired Safwan. He initially emailed me saying, hey, you should do a grant program. Here's 5 reasons why. And I was like, oh, that's actually a great idea. Will you do all the work? He's like, yeah, I'll do all the work.
Did you ever read San Francisco's subreddit?
No.
All right. So I used to go to the subreddit for San Francisco all the time. And there was this guy. It started like 5 years ago. He just said, hey, everyone. And he posted a picture of himself holding a beer. He goes, I'm at this bar. I forget. It was in Haight-Ashbury. I'm at this bar. Come down and your first drink's on me. And he just posted that. And like people made fun of him. And then he did it again the next week. And he did this for literally like 60 weeks in a row. And then he like became famous for the guy. He's like, oh, you want to have a good time. This guy seems really nice. Everyone goes to talk to him. He's a really cool dude. It'll buy your first drink, whatever. You can't, if you do that with like building cool shit, it actually works out quite well where it's like, hey, I'm building this thing. Tag along for the ride. Right. It tends to work well. The guy does it all the time. It's great. It's he like became famous for like, oh, come have first drinks on me. I'm down here. I wonder how much he spent. Dude, we used to do these mixers, these roommate mixers in San Francisco. And we would like only spend $500, but we were like the man. Like we were like the most popular people for a long time. We did it every week for like 2 years.
Well, and what were you doing? $500 went to doing what?
I bought everyone beer.
At a bar or?
At a bar. We'd host them at a bar and I would just be like, hey, can I get $2 beers? And I just come every week and I'll spend at least $500. And they're like, all right, cool. And so I was like, all right, here's my card. Stop it at 500. It was pretty sick.
Can we turn the ship around? We need to circle back. Business term.
Let me tell you about a cool company that I just discovered. And the guy told me to tell you, hey, so I don't know if you know. I don't know if that was like he's a fan or if he actually knows you. It's called I'm linking to it in here in the doc. I'm highlighting it right now. It's called getcyberleads.com. Have you ever seen this?
No. So who's the guy?
I don't know. I don't even know his name. I just DM'd him on Alex Westco.
Okay. I don't think I know this person.
He said, tell Sean I said, hey, Alex West is his name. I didn't know if he was saying it as a way that he knows you. He must just be a fan. All right.
Let's get cyber leads.
The reason it's cool is it's just him. And basically what it is you pay, let's see, how much is it? So like you pay between $100 and $1,000 a month for a bunch of different versions. But basically every month, he sends you 1,000 plus handpicked companies that just raised a lot of money and are highly likely to go and look to outsource, whether it's technology or design. They're looking to outsource stuff. And if you're an agency owner, you sign up to this, and every month you just get a bunch of new leads. And the lead list, it includes the CEO's name, the CEO's contact information, what this person is likely to outsource, where they're located, how big they are, and how much money they just raised. And the reason why this is cool is because it's so freaking simple, very clear value. It's just one person. It's making $300,000 a year. $300,000 a year. So it's making, in March, he said he did $20,000 a month with a net profit of $17,000. It's now gone up to like $30,000 a month. But I just thought this was unique. And I love these types of businesses because the value proposition is so clear. If you just, one of these things closes a deal, it's worth it. And I actually think that you could do this for a bunch of different verticals. You've never seen this before?
No, I've never seen this. How does he do the, like, what they're likely to outsource? Is he just guessing based on the industry?
So I asked him, I go, are you doing this handpicked? He goes, yeah, every report takes me 100 hours.
To do the whole leads list.
And he sends one email per month. And if you go to the website and you click live demo, you can basically see what he sends you. It's just like an Airtable table, and you can kind of see all the information.
Wow. That's kind of cool.
This is pretty cool, right?
Yeah, good for him.
It's just him. And I was like, can this scale? He goes, I think I can get $1 million a year pretty soon. And I'm not sure what I can do after that, but I think just me, this could get $1 million. And honestly, I totally agree. I think this is a beautiful business. I think this is really, really cool.
So he said, okay, let's just look at his March numbers. All right. So he said March revenue, 20,000, cost 3,000 a month, net profit, 17K, profit margin, 85%. Last March, for example, he was basically five times less. So revenue was 4,000 and now it's 20,000. And so this is pretty good. I mean, this is basically one guy and a VA can run this. One guy and a VA can run this thing, and it's providing, like you said, it's providing clear value in the sense that, like, if I pay for this, I'm likely to get more customers and make more money. So it's like it pays for itself, and like it pays for itself is actually like a pretty valuable thing, which is like, there's a bunch of things in my businesses that I'm like, oh yeah, I want to do that, but you know, I kind of have these other priorities. And it was like, well, I really do just need to look at all these things as like, can I hire somebody and it be immediately value, like, you know, accretive in the next 6 to 12 months, because that job that I'm hiring them for is not to just make my life easier. It's to literally generate revenue and profits. And so like, there is no way that if I hire this person, if they are competent, this has to be an ROI positive thing to do. And you know, the only thing I need to consider is like, do I have the bandwidth to hire this person? And so, to me, you know, like that's, and then there's products like that too. This is a product like that where it's like, yeah, I pay $99, whatever, $199 a month, whatever this thing costs. And like, if I can't make more than $199 off this, like that's just my own incompetence at that point.
It's sick, man. It's really sick. And so it says there's 1,000 leads. If you go to pricing, for the prices range from $200 to $2,000. And it says, let's see, it says you get 1,000 leads. Maybe that includes like all the past months. This is pretty cool.
By the way, check out this tweet I put in the chat. This is a good example of like content that's not like, it's like, this is the easy mode of creating content that people resonate with. So this is just a beautiful tweet. All right. So this guy tweeted out December 21st. He goes, one year ago today, I was fired from my job making $2,000 a month. Today, I'm making $6,000 a month with my own business. And he posts a screenshot of his like calendar's planner. And it says fired exclamation point. Last day at work. That's like on the 21st, on the 22nd. Day one, a self-employed man exclamation point. And it's just like, you kind of root for the person. And you know, what's in this content? It's nothing, but it's like by showing the raw like planner and like what I wrote to myself that day, like these have like an emotional impact on people. And I think that's one thing that most people get wrong in content is that content is about emotion, not information. And something like that, it generates like a feeling of like rooting for the person that is like, most people I know are really smart. And so they try to like outsmart everybody on content. And it's like, you don't need to outsmart everybody. You need to trigger an emotional response, whether it's outrage, it's like compassion, it's like, you know, awe-inspiring, whatever it is. And this is a great, simple example of how you can make somebody root for you is, you know, a little tweet like this.
This guy's a good find. I think he kind of, so there's this guy that, for context for the listener, there's a guy named Peter Lovells who I've been begging to get on the pod, and he keeps like saying yes and then ghost and yes. So, but anyway, this guy, Peter Lovells, he's not exactly a one man operation. I think now he's got contractors, but he's got like four or five different businesses. They're basically all the same thing, like job boards, collectively doing like 4 million or so in revenue. And he posts like cute, cool, insightful content on Twitter and blogs. This guy, Alex West, is kind of like in the same ballpark as that guy, Peter Lovells.
Right.
Like it's like cool, well-designed. It looks like he's like a nomad as well. By the way,
somebody needs to make the list. I feel like Steph Smith needs to do this. She needs to make the definitive list of these like solopreneur, freelancer, digital nomad. Basically, it's like the Peter Lovells, this guy, where it's like, yeah, this person's on some journey. They're trying to get to 100K a month in like personal revenue, but they have these principles. Like they're not trying to raise money. They're not trying to build a big team. They live nomadically. They're like just a good enough engineer and just good enough designer and just a good enough copywriter to make it happen. And they're like doing it all in public. And like, there's like 20 of these people that I found on Twitter. All of them are entertaining to me. And I feel like most people just don't know who those people are. And like, actually like a good service would be to just aggregate them and put it in a newsletter. Be like, hey, I'm following all these people doing this thing. Check this out. This guy posted an update about this thing. And like, you could just make a newsletter following their work and probably like, you know, build an audience of 50 to 100,000 people following you, following them, which is sort of, you know, meta.
Do you ever read Indie Hackers?
I don't personally go there much, but I have for sure, so, in the past.
Indie Hackers is awesome. It started by these two guys, Cortland and Channing. They're twins. Yeah, I've become friends with Channing over the years. Basically, it was like a forum for this weird genre of entrepreneurs called Indie Hackers, but they sold it to Stripe. And I have a feeling that each brother will make in the world of $20 million when Stripe goes public. I wouldn't be surprised if it were a little more, but I can't. I actually think it's above 20. They've never told me. I just am guessing because of when they sold to them. And if they sold for $1 million, it would have gone up by like that much. So anyway, on their website, they list interviews and they list all the revenue of the companies. And it's pretty amazing. And you could sort by revenue and you can just find like a list of companies that basically you want to like get inspired by or copy.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. And by the way, just look at their traffic. Like their traffic shows about a million to 1.5 million monthly visitors. So, you know, good job by them of like, this is like real scale. And in fact, this is probably like for Milk Road, I should go tell our story on Indie Hackers and Product Hunt. I could probably add 10,000 new subscribers with one day of like just crafting a story that goes on, that just posting on both of these.
I completely agree. I've done it both times. We did it for trends and we made a lot of money.
I like it.
HubSpot allows all our teams to work together seamlessly, so no one's fallen overboard unless we want them to.
Okay, what else you got?
I don't know. You tell me. What do you got?
I see what I'm here. Says.
Wait, I have a question. All right, yeah, let me ask that.
I think I see this question you're about to ask me.
All right. You ever seen those movies where they are, it's about like drug lords and shit, and you see just like a normal guy in a boat off the coast of Florida and he finds like a brick of cocaine?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that like premise? My question to you is because I'm reading this book. Have you seen the movie No Country for Old Men?
No.
So it's like a movie.
I've heard of it, but
you know what it is?
That name to me sounds so boring that I will never click on that.
No, it's not a boring one at all. It's like a thriller, but I'm reading the book and basically the premise is this guy like comes across a drug deal gone bad. Everyone's dead at the scene and there's $2.5 million as well as a truck full of cocaine. He takes the $2 million. The drug guys look for him and that's the book. And my question is, if I came across that cocaine, what would I do? And what would you do if you came across, like, I have no idea how cocaine is measured, but like that movie scene where you come across like
a brick.
Or many bricks, I guess. What do you do with it?
Take a picture, put it on Instagram, be like, oh my God, get the social clout and get the hell out of there. I am not picking up the cocaine. I'm not becoming a drug dealer. I'm not going to figure out how to flip this. You could also replace that with like, oh, I find a large supply of copper wires, which have a like decent market value. I don't know. I've actually been down this path before once. I think I talked about this on the pod where we met a guy who had this giant comic book card collection.
Yes.
And like, we had this opportunity to buy it for like probably like 10 cents on the dollar of what it was, like what the individual, like sum of all the parts would have been. But we had to like figure out like what the hell to do. It's like, here's a warehouse. You now have the cost of this warehouse, and then you have all this stuff, and none of it's graded, and none of it's like categorized, none of it's inventoried. It's like, you know, you got to go do that, like, you know, American Picker style, like junkyard flip type thing for this stuff. And when I kind of like, I got excited at first because it was like, it would have been a like multi-million dollar flip if we had done it.
How did that end?
It ended with me realizing this is not worth the time and energy to go do this. Like, this is so much energy.
But what, so the story was basically you came across a guy who owned a warehouse, and you said
really,
that it had
really
like,
old guy who was like finally ready to like sell his thing he'd been collecting for 30 years.
Like tens of millions of like baseball cards or something.
Yeah. Like he had millions of cards, most of which are useless, but for sure, some of it is valuable. And like, the question is like, and you had to buy the whole lot. You had to buy the whole like thing. And then
what did
you had
he
to,
do
like,
with it?
Deal with it. I think he did. No, nobody bought it because, again, nobody wants this headache. And like, even the discount, like I was like, okay, let's say this is discounted, you know, based on our estimates, this thing's discounted like 90%. Even at a 90% discount, the like mental overhead, the literal overhead. And like, some people out there are like, dude, I would have done it. And like, you should go do it. If you have no better options, you should go do this. But for me, I was like, wow, this is a lot of work. So I wouldn't do it in the legal case, let alone the illegal case of figuring out how to flip these bricks of cocaine is kind of my answer. What's your answer to that?
It depends what stage of life I'm in. All right.
So let's take it by decade. You're 20.
I'm 20. And like one of these bricks, if could they be worth like $2 million?
Let's say the whole thing is worth, you know, $6 million if you sold it all at like street value.
So let's start at the end. Of you having all this cash. Let's say you have,
we move straight to the end.
So. I'm moving straight to the end. Assuming that I had $6 million in cash, I wouldn't even know what to do with that. If you buy property with $6 million in cash, can you even do that? Are you even allowed to do that? I mean, where would you keep that money?
Yeah, I don't know what you would do. You'd have to like figure out how to like launder it basically to like legitimately own it, or you'd have to figure out a way to like do some, you know, off over the counter transaction of like gold bars or something else.
Or do you just live a cash life forever?
Yeah, you go under the mattress.
You just pay for everything with tens and twenties.
This is Breaking Bad, right? This is the plot of Breaking Bad, basically.
So what would I do if I was 20 and I found it? I don't even know what I would do. I would not be. Maybe when I was 20, maybe I wouldn't be opposed to trying something, but I literally would have no idea where to start. Where would you even start? I don't know people who do. I don't know people who do cocaine. I don't hang out with anyone.
But you're in the moment. You have to make a split decision in the heat of the moment. I would have to figure it out.
No, I'd have to call the cops. I think I would call the police. I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't even know how to execute this.
Yeah. So that's one. If you're not gonna do it in your 20s, you're not gonna do it in your 30s.
Yeah.
So I don't think it matters what stage of life you're in. There is a couple other, you know, methods here, right? So like, let's say you're in the old white country for old men or something like that. Like, you know, basically the guy finds the briefcase. If I find that briefcase, I'm taking 15% of the cash out. I'm leaving the rest there because who's really going to chase me down for the 15%. So I think I get like, you know, 80, you know, I get like
really?
Some of the reward, none of the work.
That is the easiest. So I did the math. So the book was set in 1979 and it was $2.5 million, which is the equivalent of like $8 million today. So finding $8 million today, and this is set in El Paso, Texas, and the guy lives in a trailer, like a mobile home. So $7 million might as well be $700 million. It's just a world changing thing. If I'm that guy, like that's easy. You just find it, you get the car, and you just never go back home, and you're just gone.
Yeah, but I'm what am I going to do? Sleep, you know, with one eye open every night, wondering what's going to happen. If I see that $2 million, I'm taking $247,000 out.
No way.
I'm saying they're going to not even understand why $247,000 short. And I'm living a happy, calm lifestyle, just as my life was, but with an extra $247,000. That's my move.
That's so funny. I don't think I could take 15%. I would definitely take the whole thing.
I was thinking about this the other day. This came up. I watched Survivor. Yeah, I'm like still watching. You know, season 48 of whatever Survivor that's going on. And shout out to the Survivor casting directors. I'm getting in shape so that I can go on Survivor soon. But they have this new twist where they have this thing you find. And normally it's like Survivor, you go out in the wild and they have this little prize called the Immunity Idol. If you find this thing, you're safe from the vote. You won't get voted out this week. So people always want that thing. And when they find it, it's this joyous moment. They unscroll the scroll and they're like, yes, I found the thing. But they added a twist this time, which it says on the top of the scroll, it says, beware. Like, this is called a beware advantage. Like, you know, there could be something good. This comes with power, but also, you know, some drawbacks. And they say you could just put this down right now and you can go on with the game as it is. Or if you open this, you have to, you know, you get the power, but you get the disadvantage as well. You get the advantage and disadvantage. 100% of the time they open up the scroll. And I'm just thinking there, I'm like, you know, the game theory here is that this is going to put me in a sticky spot. They're not giving me something that's going to give me like, it's mostly great with a tiny downside. It's going to be like potentially great later with a downside today, right? Like if I'm the game, that's how I'm organizing this game. But everybody picks it up and everybody opens it. And I thought, what are the things in life that are like this? Which is like, you pick it up, you know you shouldn't do this. You know this has like drawbacks, but you can't resist. You just do it anyways because, you know, YOLO. And like I started thinking about like what that is in real life, right? Like there's that with food, like most junk food is that way, you know, pleasure now, pain later. You know, but what are the other areas of life? Like, you know, what is the career version of this? This is like that you got that really great job. But like now, but like, you know, you were thinking about maybe you wanted to start your own business or do your own thing. But then you get this like, you know, job at McKinsey and you're tempted to take it because it has the prestige and it has the money. But it also comes with the sticky trap of like, this is for sure going to set you on a path for multiple years in a direction that you don't think you want to be your end goal, but you do it anyways. And so I'm now looking out for these, what I'm calling the beware advantages of life.
The big takeaway here, though, is with you wanting to go on Survivor. So let me tell you about something. So there's this podcast called Dead Eyes. Do you know what Dead Eyes is?
No, never heard of it.
All right. So years ago, Tom Hanks was the producer of Band of Brothers. You know, it was like the TV show on HBO about World War II. And there was this one comedian who was like an extra of one of the guys who was shooting or something. And Tom Hanks like looked at him and then whispered in the producer or whispered in his assistant's ear and said like, hey, man, you got to go. Tom Hanks apparently said that he had, quote, dead eyes and he wanted him off the set. Like he just didn't like him as an extra. Something that probably happens all the time. He just thought, and so
just a flex.
Yeah, it wasn't working out. And so this guy created a podcast called Dead Eyes, and the whole podcast was questioning why he got kicked off like Band of Brothers.
That same guy. Okay.
Yes. And so the whole podcast, the whole premise is like he's interviewing people on Band of Brothers, like asking like, why do you think I got kicked off? Like what? Like, let's talk through this.
Dude, how did you find this? Sounds like the most obscure of the obscure.
Well, eventually Tom Hanks goes on it.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
And he lands Tom Hanks and he comes on as a guest and he explains like what was happening from his perspective. And what we need to do with you.
Well, wait, hold on. What was the explanation? What did he say? Or he was just like, I don't remember.
he was like, I'm sorry. It wasn't. Let me see. He's like,
this has haunted you for 24 years.
Yeah. He was like this. I guess it just wasn't even like he didn't really think about it, I believe. And apparently he said that like it was like a mistake. Like maybe he said the wrong thing to the wrong person, but like it just dismissed him. Like it wasn't even like an issue in his life. And this guy has this whole podcast called Dead Eyes. You've not heard of this? It's hilarious.
No, that's hilarious. What were you going to tie that in? You said I should do something.
Well, so with you wanting to be on Survivor, we need to like have you go through the whole process and you're likely going to get turned down at the audition, but we got to like do like a whole series of episodes of you going through this process of getting on Survivor and documenting it and getting
That's a great idea.
And we like what you need to do is comment, get the person who does casting for Survivor and act like you want them to come on as a guest. And we could do it just to like humor them, but like on air, be like, so like, can Sean audition?
I have auditioned before already, so I've been rejected once. So I already got that under my belt.
We got to have him on air and we'll do it like funny. Like, you know, I think I said this earlier, like, wouldn't it be funny if we just started kissing right now? Like, wouldn't that be hilarious? Like, that's got to be.
So what if I was on?
Yeah, like, wouldn't it be hilarious? Imagine that. Can you imagine if I came on the Survivor and if
like
I
what actually, would happen? Yeah. Like, is that allowed?
Yeah. Wouldn't it be funny?
Dude, what is the exact line though? Wouldn't it be funny if we like, what would happen if we just kissed right now? Wouldn't it be funny if we kissed? That's so funny to me, dude. That tickles my funny bone at the like deepest level. I don't know why. It's so funny. There's that one, and then there's the other one that like gets me so bad is like, have you heard this joke where it's like, and then everybody started clapping?
No.
Okay, so basically this is it's like a recurring joke that comes in when like, if you tell a story,
yeah,
that like it's like when somebody tells a story and by the end of the story you're sort of like, wait, what was the point of the story? And then you realize the point of the story was them just saying how cool they were in a way that was like not even like the story's kind of exaggerated or not really believed. It's like, yeah, we were at the restaurant and then this guy was choking and then like, but like nobody heard him, but I just saw it. I was on my way to the bathroom and I just kind of like, you know, whatever, just did the Heimlich, but I'd only ever watched the video and like, and you're like, what is this story? Where is this going? Why are you telling me this? And then you basically like, it's an awkward silence at the end of that story. And they're like, and then they realize the story didn't do it. And so they have to one up it and just say, and then everybody started clapping. And so it's this genre of stories, and then everybody started clapping stories.
My version.
Those also crack me up when I see someone get stuck in a story like that. I'm like, oh, yes, it's happening. They got themselves trapped in a, and then everybody started clapping story and they're about to start exaggerating because the story itself didn't hit and now they're stuck.
My version of that is, and then I found $5.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, okay, so I have a crazy story like this. Somebody tweeted this at us.
They loved your Orlando Bloom story, by the way.
Yeah, oh, that's the one where I didn't want to get stuck in that spot, but that story is all true. So somebody tweeted at this at us and they go, this seems like it's up your alley. And that's when you know you're winning, when somebody sends you something really weird and they say, I think this is up your alley. And it's 100% up my alley. This is my home address, my P.O. box is in this alley. And so he sent me this post and it's like a forum post. And he goes, what I'm doing is insane. So here's what it says. It goes, I have a bot running 24/7 that is buying and selling for zero target profit just to waste the IRS's manpower and money. I print and send to the IRS all the documentation about every one of these trades in paper form so that they can't automate it or like, you know, just like get through my report in an easy way. He goes, I will sometimes mix blank pages, double print, ghost print, use black and white. I will number the pages and put them in out of order. I will have people randomly scribbling drawings of dicks into the pages. I will send it as a whole palette of paper trades. I even, to send this palette, I have to hire a guy with a forklift just to send it. And I want it to be in a palette so that it is maximally like troublesome for them. And then it says like, you know,
is this real?
Yeah, I don't know if it's real or not. This is like some forum post. He goes, this costs me thousands of dollars every year. And I make sure to send them an invoice so that they know that I'm paying real money on top of the palette that I've sent them. So whoever's in charge of this knows that I'm wasting the equivalence of 2 months of their wage on this asinine behavior on top of wasting their time. And I was just like, this needs to go to petty court. It's like, who are you? Why are you so troubled? And like, okay, you know, if you just wasted a little bit of your own time, that's offensive to me. But if you waste all of your time and money, at this point, it turns into respect from my point of view. And like, I don't know what your mission is. I don't even really understand it. But I respect the mission drivenness of this, like of this initiative where there's no gain. It's just mutually assured destruction on both parties.
It's like, have you seen on South Park where Cartman is dressed up like Steve Jobs at the keynote and he's walking around and he goes, instead of saying thank you, he just says, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And the whole presentation is ways that they're wasting money. And he's sitting around walking around the stage and he goes, but we didn't just stop there. You see, we moved the couch from the left part of the room to the right part of the room. And the whole presentation is just how they just reorganized the furniture in his office that quarter. That was all they did with all their money. And this is a good example of that.